And first, I want to apologize to Barry because I put out an announcement inadvertently misspelling his name. And Judy, who's one of our people here, called me on it, and Barry called me on it also. And I apologize for that. I was an academic once, so I know what that's about. Our speaker is going to discuss the Jerusalem Declaration on Antisemitism. We all remember about 5 years ago when the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance put out their definition, and we all worried it would limit speech, it would stifle speech, especially critical of Israel. We, LA Jews for Peace and others, we fought locally. We stopped the UC Regents and the state of California from either adopting it or putting in some close resemblance to the IHRA. Barry was part of a group of academic Holocaust and Jewish studies specialists who, rather than fight the IHRA directly, they put out an alternative, a document that would be better or would be less problematic. And that's what we're going to hear about tonight. Barry was one of the authors of that document, and he signed it. And in the announcement, I quote a piece that he wrote where he sort of tells us why he signed it and even admits that there are some problems in the document. Barry's talk will be, or this session will be a little short because Barry will have to leave in about an hour or so for family issues. But I welcome everyone to stay on and we can carry on the discussion afterwards. Let's see if anything. Okay, so I give it to you, Barry Trachtenberg.
All right, well, thank you. Thanks very much, Jeff. And thank you all for this chance to meet with you. I was a graduate student at UCLA in the late 90s and early 2000s and was one of the founders of a group called LA Jews for Just Peace, where we staged many demonstrations in front of the federal building and in front of the Israeli consulate. When I saw the invitation from Jeff, I was really sort of thrilled to be able to talk with you.
That we started in 2006. Yeah. This group started in 2006 during the Second Lebanese War. And we've been meeting continuously, and we've done a lot of protests in front of the federal building, the old consulate and the new consulate.
Oh, I didn't know the consulate had moved. All right. All right. Well, I'm really glad to be here. As Jeff said, I was one of the people who helped to craft the Jerusalem definition of anti-Semitism. I'm a historian of Jewish history. Like I said, I did my training at UCLA, among other places. I work in Holocaust studies and Yiddish studies, and also the intersection between those two. And for several years, I've been speaking about the use and sort of misuse of the accusation of anti-Semitism. I testified to Congress in 2017 against the attempt to pass the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which was a piece of legislation that had been promoted by a group such as the Anti-Defamation League, the World Jewish Congress, AIPAC, and others, which would have gone a very long way to codify this other definition, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which I'll talk about in a second, into law. We were able to defeat that, which was terrific. Also testifying with me against it was the head of the Association for Jewish Studies, as well as one of the figures who actually helped to author the IHRA definition, who himself said it was not ever intended to be written into law. So I'll just give a little bit of the backstory to how the Jerusalem definition, Declaration on Antisemitism came about. So around the year 2000, as part of yet another sort of wave of anti-Semitism that was happening in Europe, a European monitoring group brought together several scholars to try to come up with a way to study this phenomenon. And this group of scholars put together what became known as a working definition on anti-Semitism. That definition I can show you if I'll share my screen for a moment here. Sorry, this will just take me a second to get this right. Here. All right, so can you see my screen now? Yes, so in sure. That box, you'll see, yeah, so the definition, this was known as a working definition of anti-Semitism. And by working, what they meant was it was used to help the work of combating anti-Semitism, but it also was meant to be a definition that was sort of in process, not a permanent definition by any means. What they wrote, you can see in the box there, anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews, rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, towards Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. So this by itself is not particularly problematic, other than it doesn't really say very much, right? It doesn't tell us what is anti-Semitism, what isn't anti-Semitism. The language is kind of awkward, a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred. And so in some ways, in part because of the lack of clarity of this definition, they then put out a whole series of examples of when things may be anti-Semitic. Some of these I think we would all agree on, such as this here, accusing Jews as a people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoing committed by a single Jewish person, accusing Jews of exaggerating the Holocaust and so on. But some of the pieces were really quite disconcerting, you know, to many people. For example, denying the Jewish right, the Jewish people the right to self-determination by claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Applying double standards by requiring of it, meaning Israel, behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation, drawing comparisons to contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis, right? So there's a whole series of definitions that were of concern to people. And what became more of a concern was that the use of the IRA definition, after it became adopted by a group known as the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which was an NGO made up of more than 30 countries, adopting this definition, it became used almost exclusively as a way to criticize or ways to stop criticism of Israel. It became codified into legislation in many states around the world. Many universities have begun to use it, and especially in the last few years, many governments, organizations, businesses, schools, even sports teams have adopted the IRA definition, but have not used it in any way to attack white supremacists, racial nationalists, sort of what we would think of as, you know, classic anti-Semites, but almost exclusively as a way to stop Palestinians from speaking about their experience living under Israeli rule, and for allies of Palestinians to express their solidarity with them. It's been used to combat the movement for BDS. It's been used against those who would compare Israel to apartheid. It has been used to censor speech. It's been used by Facebook. It's been used by YouTube to prevent scholarly presentations about Palestine from going forward, from groups to be active on their platforms. And this is obviously a very, very serious problem. And it was out of that concern that I testified to Congress in 2017. But it became clear that an alternative definition was needed. Now, when I testified to Congress in 2017, one of my primary concerns was about the idea of having definitions of anti-Semitism at all, definitions that could potentially be codified into law. And as I testified to Congress then, you know, a primary concern of mine was that at the root of anti-Semitism is a belief that the Jews are exceptional in the world, that there's not a place for Jews in the world, that they're ultimately incommensurate with the societies that they inhabit, right? If we think back to ancient times, Jews are accused of being Christ killers, and, you know, in the medieval ages, they're accused of trying to undermine Christianity and the formation of Christian Europe. In the more modern period, they're seen as either, you know, capitalists out to destroy sort of traditionalist agrarian ways of life, or they're communists out to destroy the capitalist way of life. Like, we're familiar with all of these forms of anti-Semitism. And so my concern was that by having a code of speech that's specific to Jews, it would reinforce these ideas of Jews are a people about whom special laws need to be made. For a long time, this is really the view that I held. And then in very early 2020, a group of scholars started to form saying, we're going to create a new definition of anti-Semitism. And I was very hesitant to join that initiative initially out of those concerns for Jewish exceptionalism. But in time, after participating in these very early discussions, and we were actually supposed to meet initially in May of 2020 in Jerusalem. And I remember in late February, being in Toronto about to give a talk in at Queen's University in Kingston. Remember February 28th, buying a ticket for Jerusalem and for May 15th, figuring, oh, the pandemic will long be over by then, and so on, which of course that didn't happen. And so we just began meeting monthly via Zoom from about June onward, 2020. And it took, the conversations took about a full year ultimately, from the very first time we started having these preliminary conversations to the time we began to gather sort of groups of scholars together. And so over the course of these monthly or so meetings that we had, we ultimately decided to come up with our own sort of statement on anti-Semitism. And so what we produced, and I'll share my screen again, is something called the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism. Now, although we have a definition, which I'll also show to you, we were clear to make the point that we weren't just putting out yet another definition, that we wanted to provide guidance on how to speak about anti-Semitism, how to identify it, and more importantly, to try to correct many of the ills that we saw that were inherent within the IHRA definition. In particular, we wanted to make sure to try to find ways to open up the possibilities for Palestinians to speak about their experiences of living under Israeli rule and to do so in a way that would not allow people to immediately condemn that speech as anti-Semitic. So if you look at this definition, you can see the link here is simply JerusalemDeclaration.org. There's kind of a long preamble that locates this definition in the history of human rights law, the 1948 Universal Declaration, the 69 Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, 2000 Declaration Stockholm International Forum on the Holocaust, in 2005, UN Resolution Holocaust Remembrance. And so we got together with to engage in this and to try to provide an alternative to this definition that could be used. I'll let you look at all of this, you know, on your own, but I'll just kind of go through a few of this.
Excuse me, Ruth, can you please Ruth, can you please mute your phone?
Somebody holds in the wall.
Yeah.
Ruth, yeah, please mute yourself.
So it has to be painted. And there are a couple problems.
Yep, you're the host. You can mute anybody.
Care of them.
I can't when this screen is being.
Why don't you put something in now?
I got it. I was able to do it.
All right.
Sure. Thanks for making me co-host. I didn't know I could do that. So you'll see here, we also start with a definition that's a little more straightforward, right? Anti-Semitism is discrimination, prejudice, hostility, or violence against Jews as Jews or Jewish institutions as Jewish. But again, like all definitions, it will need clarification. And here, following this, we have, I think it's 15, 16 different sort of guidelines as a way to try to identify what is, and unlike the IRA definition, what isn't anti-Semitism. The first five of these pieces are ones that are probably pretty straightforward, right? It's racist to essentialize or to make sweeping negative generalizations about given population. What is true of racism is true as anti-Semitism in particular. I actually think this is, although this is perhaps a very kind of straightforward statement, it's actually quite powerful because what it does is it links anti-Semitism to other forms of systematic oppression, right? It links anti-Semitism to racism and draws those ties, which is something that helped me with my hesitation about the idea about exceptionalizing anti-Semitism. So in this way, it de-exceptionalizes anti-Semitism and locates it as part of other projects, or at least linked to other projects of racial discrimination. Then there's discussions on the questions of the sort of classical form of anti-Semitism, that it can be manifested in different ways. It can be direct, indirect, explicit, coded, denying, minimizing the Holocaust, it's clear. And then we have two sections, B and C, that contend directly with the question of Israel and Palestine. And the reason why we did this was because this is clearly the sticking point that where the guidance is needed. This is also one of the great points of critique about the definition, that it overemphasizes the Israel-Palestine question and takes away from in many ways the real, we might think of, or the most prevalent sources of anti-Semitism, which is that coming from the right, coming from white supremacy. But this is one of the decisions that the group raised coming out of our discussions. And so there's some points to say very clearly, like how to talk about Israel-Palestine, what is, you know, on the face of it, anti-Semitic, right? Applying images of classical anti-Semitism to the state of Israel, right? Saying that the state of Israel is out to say, destroy the whole world, right? We know that it's not true. Obviously, Israel's for all of its, you know, crimes and misdeeds is not out for, say, global domination, right? Holding all Jews everywhere in the world collectively responsible for Israel, assuming that all Jews everywhere are Zionists simply because they're Jews and so on. Number 10 is a point that I'd be very happy to kind of discuss with you at length. Now I'm going to stop talking in about two more minutes. This was perhaps the most contentious guideline of our whole group and led to many, many, many hours of discussion. It took on many iterations. Number 10 states that denying the right of Jews in the state of Israel to exist and flourish collectively and individually as Jews in accordance with the principle of equality. I'll move along, but I just wanted to point that out so we can talk about it. And then the last several documents are pieces that are examples of anti-Semitic or of speech acts that are not on the face of it anti-Semitic, whether or not one approves of it. And this talks about supporting Palestinian demands for justice and the full granting of their rights, opposing Zionism as a form of nationalism, arguing for new ways to imagine the governance of the space between the river and the sea, to argue for a binational state, a federal state, any sort of form to, you know, argue that all inhabitants of the territory should be treated as equal citizens, evidence-based citizen, BDS, comparisons with apartheid, and so on. And so this was the declaration that we put forward. Now, as I've said, it's you know, been subjected to a series of criticisms, that, some of which have come from Palestinian civil society, which I'm happy to share with you, but many of which I agree with, and then some coming from the far right as well, sort of in some ways the kind of also the Jewish mainstream. The JDA is gaining traction, which is really terrific. There's been several instances now in Canada, in some in the United States, some in England, where the Jerusalem definition is starting to halt the kind of the seemingly unrelenting progress of the IRA definition. We've just received a very significant grant to do activism here in the United States around this definition. And the violence of the last, 2 weeks or so has presented new challenges for us, which I'd also be happy to discuss with you. But I'll stop there. I know I've sort of been talking for a while. I'll stop sharing my screen so we can have a discussion about it. But if people want to look up at the definition themselves while we're talking, I will put it in the chat so folks can see it. And yes, Aviva, you're right. The far right is not the Jewish mainstream. I'm conflating that. Unfortunately, sometimes it does seem like the Jewish right and the Jewish center are though often in alliance with one another. So I'll stop there and, let's have a discussion about it.
Okay, thank you, Barry. You can ask to speak either by raising a hand like Dick just did, or go to the reactions on the bottom of your screen, and under reactions, you can raise your hand electronically. So do either of those things, and we'll start with Dick.
Hi, Barry. Barry, I was also at UCLA in sociology, not in history. And when I was there, I spent a lot of time reading all these studies by the Anti-Defamation League on anti-Semitism. And they were almost all gathered by survey research, and they almost all measured attitudes. And their theory was attitudes lead to behavior, behavior leads to institutional discrimination. So I argued they had it backwards, that racism is not just a bunch of people, prejudiced people acting out, but it's institutional activity. So how does this definition address racism against Jews, which is institutional, like quotas in medical school, private clubs that discriminate against Jews, fraternity? I mean, most of these things have disappeared in the United States, racial covenants, racial and religious covenants. Yeah. They're all gone at this point. I mean, Jews don't experience any structural race, anti-Semitism anymore in the United States, just an occasional.
Do you want dinner?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know.
I just muted Marty too. So you're right. I mean, we don't have those kinds of codes anymore, right? Happily, we've moved away from the phenomena that was so vitriolic and defined much of the experience of Jews. You know, certainly in the 20s, 30s, really through the 50s and 60s or so. So we don't really contend with that so much, right? Because that's not the issue that we're facing. I find your analysis really fascinating. I'd like to kind of hear more about that work that you did looking at that and sort of flipping the relationship between those two things. Certainly they reinforce one another, right? Individual attitudes, are reflected in institutions, and those then help to shape individual attitudes. There's obviously a relationship that kind of moves back and forth between them. But our definition or declaration doesn't really contend with that very much. Really the key goal here is to halt the momentum of the IRA definition, which is so centered around the misuse of anti-Semitism trying to stop Palestinian speech.
Well, if no one else is ready, I will ask Barry to go back to number 10, which guideline number 10, which read denying the right of Jews in the state of Israel to exist and flourish collectively and individually as Jews in accordance with the principle of equality.
Yeah, did you want to make any comment on that, or just would you like me to discuss about that?
No, just ask you to expand on the comment.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So, like I said, this was a very large sticking point. So I hesitated for a long time over this language. And this language was actually the result of many, many hours of compromise. One group thought the definition was settled when it had language along these lines, and we kept going back trying to tune it. The reason why I find it challenging and why I hesitated about signing it and why it's a sticking point for some Palestinian activists, although not all, is because they see that the, you know, Israel is their oppressors. They see it as a colonialist enterprise. And why should they as Palestinians recognize the right of their colonizers to exist and flourish in the land that they've colonized? I mean, from that point of view, that logic makes a lot of sense, right? Why should the colonized recognize the right of the colonizers to flourish in the lands that, that they've occupied? The reason why, though, that this language ultimately had to be here in the definition was that we were trying to create a document that was international in its scope. We wanted a document that could not only speak to American audiences, but also Canadian audiences and British audiences and German audiences, that could be used in many different parts of the world. And the conversations around anti-Semitism and Israel are very, very different that in other parts of the world than they are here in the United States. And without language such as this, the Jerusalem Declaration would not have been able to gather the number of signatories that it gathered and the prestige of the signatories that it gathered, and the international scope of scholars that we ended up being able to get. You know, it became very, very clear, for example, that without this language, that this would have in many ways hung our colleagues out in England and in Germany sort of out to dry, that it would have gained no traction whatsoever in those states where there just simply does not exist the level of conversation about Israel-Palestine that we see here in the United States. A case in point, the leader of Electronic Intifada, Ali Abu Nimia, for example, was on German television in the last few days talking about the, you know, the crisis that just happened in Gaza. And he talked about Israel, and he talked about, he used the word colonization, and he used the word apartheid. And he did this on Deutsche Welle, which is, you know, the public broadcasting system. And they pulled his speech, or they pulled his interview from the archive because he used those words. So simply, you simply can't even talk about certain things in those countries. So he ended up needing to have the word, this language. And again, this was language of compromise. You know, the earlier versions for this talked about security, you know, well-defined borders for the state of Israel. We were able to remove that language. Sort of the more progressives in the group really fought very hard to kind of take that language out, because that's language that has been used by the state of Israel to justify its provocative assaults on Palestinians and on many of its neighbors over the years. And ultimately, this was the language of compromise. And so this is how we ended up. But it also is, like I said, it's a sticking point with many Palestinian activists, although others have decided to accept the JDA with reservations. And the reservations are not exclusively on this, but largely about this point number 10.
If no one else has a question, I'll follow up. Okay, I'll follow up. I mean, if the Palestinian, I mean, if there's the, If there was a one-state solution, wouldn't the Palestinians want half their population to be flourishing?
Potentially, but here it says denying the right of Jews in the state of Israel to exist and flourish. I mean, so this is the piece that's contentious. What doesn't exist here is, you know, a 10B, for example, that would say denying the right of Palestinians to exist and flourish collectively and individually as Palestinians in accordance with the principle of equality, right? That language is not there. You know, several of us fought for this. You know, I fought for that or for some modification of it. But again, ultimately, it was a product of compromise. And there's some people who, and I know we're being recorded, so I won't name names, but there's some people who decided that they couldn't sign on to this, even with the statement. For other people, they were concerned that this was going too far, right? And so again, it's a product of compromise, because what we needed to do was to put forward a document that could compete with the IRA definition. And if it was a document that was seemingly coming from the more left end of the spectrum, it's not going to speak to the Biden administration. It's not going to speak to the UN. It's not going to speak to the centers where policy is actually being created. So we had to figure out a place where we could present it as more of a progressive liberal document, and so that would be sufficient enough to gain supporters from a broader swath of the political spectrum, and could then enter into the conversation, right? Because we've had lots and lots of statements, right, from Jewish Voice for Peace, for example, on whose board I sit, or the academic advisory board, from the BDS movement and others, right? And those are vital. And, I've had a hand in some of those, and I'm a member of those organizations, but they're not entering into the places where policy is being made. And so the thinking of this group is, who are the experts in the field? Who are the people in Holocaust studies and anti-Semitism studies and Jewish studies who are thinking about these questions and who are horrified by this seemingly relentless advance of the IRA definition? And how can we put our heads together to come up with something, try to put like a roadblock in its path, right? And try to muddy the waters. And we were pretty successful. I mean, there's signatories on this document where I was quite shocked to see that I'm on the same, effectively, set of signatories as they are. There's people like that I never thought this document would speak to, such as, say, Michael Walzer, who's a very strong, ardent Zionist, right? And I was surprised, a little appalled in some ways, that we were on the same document, but also it was a sign of success that it's meeting this fairly broad need, that it has very, very strong pro-Palestinian activists, like, say, Richard Falk on there. So it's got those credentials as well. And so, and it's in the weeks leading up to its release, we met with a whole series of people and leaders from Palestinian civil society, with, Omar Barghouti, others, to talk with them about this document. They didn't have a hand in shaping it. We wrote many of the FAQs and sort of in response to those discussions. I wrote my piece in Jewish Currents, that came out the next day, in part to give sort of credence and space to those arguments, and to speak to their legitimacy, to the critique of it. But in the end, I think that, we seem to have struck a good place. And now the work in some ways really begins. Now, activists like yourselves and others need to debate this, I think, needs to think about, is there a place for this declaration? And if it's something that you can get behind, whether you agree with it in all or just in part, and put it forward to help at least muddy the debate, right? At minimum, we can make the case that the IRA definition is not the end all and be all of how we should be thinking about anti-Semitism, that there are competing definitions now, and people need to recognize that there's a debate within the Jewish community itself over what constitutes anti-Semitism. There's a debate within the Jewish community that, and part of which recognizes that Palestinians have the right to speak about their experiences without it being controlled and monitored by those who would simply dismiss it by declaring that it's prima facie anti-Semitism. And this is what we seek to achieve with this JDA.
Dick.
You're muted, sorry, Dick.
I was interested in what the debate was over the issue of self-determination, because it opens up a can of worms. If you say that Jews have a right to self-determination, then why would Palestinians not have a right to self-determination? I mean, it's very problematic. And I did a little reading about it, it mostly is attributed to section one of the Charter of the United Nations. And it doesn't mean that your self-determination doesn't even mean a nation state based on it. So there must have been quite a spirited discussion over what that actually means.
There was, and this is one of the other places where I have deep hesitation about the JDA, but I still signed it, you know, for the reasons that I've talked about. I mean, the notion of self-determination is, it's a fairly new one, right? It comes out of the movement of nationalism. It actually comes out of debates around the League of Nations, you know, at the end of World War I, and then really, you know, takes on this steam after World War II. I mean, of course, most nations of the world don't have states of their own, right? I mean, the Welsh don't have a state, and the Scots don't have a state, and the Catalans don't have a state, and right? So most peoples of the world don't get to have states of their own, right? So the idea of self-determination, you're absolutely right, does not automatically mean statehood, right? But what it means is that, and this was something that Jews worked very, very passionately for in the 1920s and 30s in Europe itself, was the right to live their lives as Jews and to have some modicum of control over the institutions that shape their lives and be able to speak sort of collectively as Jews, right? It was not talked about in the terms of self-determination, but it was talked about in the terms of minority rights and national minority rights. And so groups like the Jewish Labor Bund and others, right, that you may be familiar with, right? You know, they really fought very hard for these principles. But you're absolutely right that once sort of the tables are turned after the war and when there is a Jewish state, the whole question of self-determination only becomes one of Jewish self-determination and then a complete refusal to recognize Palestinians as a people, right? I mean, this is Golda Meir's famous statement that there are no Palestinians, that they don't exist as a people. And so it's a problem that just, I think, reproduces itself over and over again. And the question of self-determination is a very, very, I think, problematic one, because who gets to decide what self-determination looks like? You know, for me, I would say certainly Jewish self-determination, is not represented by the state of Israel, right? As Jews, you know, I want us to be able to get together, to be able to talk as Jews, to have our institutions, to have our organizations, to kind of move forward. But I certainly don't want to govern over other people as Jews. I certainly don't want to oppress other peoples as Jews. To me, that's antithetical to what it means to be Jewish. So I absolutely agree with you. If you believe in the notion of self-determination, you have to then extend it to Palestinians. But Israel, of course, refuses to recognize Palestinians as a people.
David.
Yeah. Hi, Barry. As I wrote in the chat, sorry for being late. I had an overlapping meeting that I had to be at. So I hope I'm not being repetitive, but I'll just say that as you know, we've corresponded and I've written publicly as well. I thought the declaration was very important and very positive, and I think it's had an impact. You don't hear a lot. So I haven't studied it, you know, in depth, but I have certainly the impression is that I don't see nearly as much insistence on the IHRA definition as I did before this came out, and I think people are considering it. The fact that Michael Walzer signed it. You know, I think that it's a good thing. And just like I and probably you and probably a lot of other people on this call moved at some point in our trajectories from where he has been to where we are now, maybe he will too. I wouldn't, you know, it's always possible. I was surprised and pleased by the fact that he signed it. And I thought, you know, most of the criticism that somehow this was feeding into the belief that anti-Semitism has to be discussed in the context of Israel-Palestine. I disagree with that. This was very distinctly in a response to IHRA, and IHRA did that. So of course this is going to have to do that. It doesn't say that that's the only place. In fact, it clearly says that anti-Semitism needs to be opposed along with other racism everywhere. And you know, it says all the right things about that. And just finally about self-determination, the only reference I see in the document to self-determination is a very generic one in paragraph number 13. It doesn't mention it specifically regarding the rights of Jews or even Israelis. Others I know differ, but I don't think it's wrong to say that Israeli Jews have become, have evolved into a national group, and therefore they have the right of self-determination too. They have exercised it in a way that's offensive, and therefore what they've done has to be opposed. And no one has the right to exercise self-determination at the expense of another, of the rights of another people. That's not really complicated, and I don't have a problem with saying it in that way, which the declaration doesn't go into that specifically, but I think it kind of implies that, and I think that's fine. So thank you for doing it.
Thanks, David. Yeah, it's nice to see your face. You and I have corresponded for years, but I've never actually seen one another, I think. So yeah, thanks for that.
There are about 300 signatures to this document, but there was a much smaller group that were the authors, right?
Yeah. So there was I've been thinking of this in sort of concentric circles in a way, that there was a very core group of somewhere between 6 and 8 people who instigated the process and were central to its the actual writing of the language. And then there was a larger group that was between about 17 and 20 of us. And I was part of that next circle out, where we weighed in on the different drafts that were being put forward in these monthly meetings that we had. And then there's this larger circle of signatories that were gathered once the group of 20 or so came to agreement on the final language. Since then, some of the group of 20 have been working very actively in their home countries to get this definition put forward. And the activism has taken place mostly in the United States, in Canada, in England, and in Germany, where there's different groups of activists, some scholars, some Jewish peace groups who've been working to promote this definition. And that's kind of where things stand at the moment. I expect in the next couple of months, we'll see sort of a burst of activism, you know, now that kind of the scholars, kind of we've done our work, that activists are going to start moving with us. I think there'll be a much more dynamic website. There'll be a much stronger online presence for this on social media. There'll be more campaigns to get people to be contacting members of their legislature. There'll be activism within campus groups and amongst scholarly organizations as well, trying to get this definition sort of out into the world. That's not the work that I know how to do, right? I mean, I just sit mostly with old Yiddish books and, you know, try to piece them together. And, you know, I'm not an activist in that way, but there's activists who are going to be soon coming on board to help carry this definition forward, which is great.
And we should just follow those groups in doing our part.
Yeah, and you know, join if this definition is something that your group wants to get behind. You know, so where you see organizations, whether it's, you know, city councils or universities or, you know, legislatures who are starting to think, you know, given this kind of recent, you know, rise of anti-Semitism has happened, or say we need a new definition, we need to put, you know, to show their solidarity with Jews, you know, sign up with the IRA definition as a Jewish organization, speak out against it and say, here's an alternative. You know, if they insist on having a definition, I think that the Jerusalem Declaration does a much better job than the IRA one will. And I think, you know, that's a case that needs to be made.
Pini.
Has there been any reaction from Israelis in terms of any activists there with regard to this? I know this is an important document for the diaspora, but.
Yeah. So many of the scholars who helped put together the definition are Israelis themselves. And there are also Palestinians who are Israeli citizens who were part of the discussions also. Many of whom didn't sign it in the end because they realized it's sort of a Jewish document in a way, not necessarily out of disagreement with it. So there's been discussions in the Israeli press. There's been articles in Haaretz, in the Jewish Times, in the Jerusalem Post, and you can kind of imagine where those arguments have landed in some ways. But you know, I don't know the extent to which Israel itself is interested in sort of taking on the IHRA definition, right? That you know, they don't necessarily, in that sense, need it. It's, you know, because certainly under the present government, although that may be changing, you know, they're just setting their own standards. I think where the activism is happening is much more so outside of Israel at the moment. You know, but the truth is that most of the push to get the IHRA definition accepted is being bankrolled by Israel. They've been pretty explicit about this, that they're pushing Facebook and YouTube and Twitter to adopt the IHRA definition. They are the force that's pushing groups like the ADL and others to advocate for the IHRA definition. Like that's, you know, much of that's being directed by Israel.
The recent spate of of incidents reported, presumably from Palestinians against Israelis, I have sort of two questions I'd like you to talk about. One is, how is this going to affect the adoption of the Jerusalem Declaration? And others, there's been the other side is that there's been some evidence that some of that these incidents were falsely reported, like the one in LA on La Cienega with a sushi shop. But there's been also things, the one in New York and several others. So I was wondering how you could react to these two sides of this issue.
Sure, yeah. I think that the reporting of the, you know, this new sort of spike in anti-Semitism is gonna make it harder for us without a question, at least in the short term. Mostly around the question of the anti-Semitism czar, right, that the Biden administration needs to appoint, right? There's supposed to be sort of an anti-Semitism czar who's working with the administration. There's lots of debates about who that should be. We've been trying to get the question of the JDA in the mix on those. I think this will make it harder for us. You know, we don't know what's going to happen next and what's going to happen down the line. But, you know, on the one hand, there's been clearly, you know, attacks on Jews that have happened and on Jewish institutions, right? I mean, there's synagogues that have been defaced with swastikas and so on. You know, people attacked on the streets for, you know, presenting themselves as Jews outwardly. Like, you know, the JDA helps give guidance in point that that's anti-Semitic, right? That's just what it is. At the same time, groups like the ADL, right? We know that their definition of anti-Semitism, in part based on the IHRA definition, includes also strong criticism of Israel. And so I think we always have to be wary about, like, you know, who's measuring anti-Semitism and for what reasons and how, and we have to pay attention to it. So when they say, you know, there's a, you know, however many fold increase, well, we have to say, show us those numbers, show us what those are based on. And very often what we see is it's people who are, you know, making very, very just strong criticisms of the state, right? For its policies, not because that state is necessarily Jewish. And we have to be able to discern that. And this is where I think the JDA can be helpful in that way, right? Because it calls out anti-Semitism when it exists, when people are making sort of classic charges of anti-Jewish hatred, when they're declaring that all Jews are somehow responsible for the state of Israel, or saying that Israel represents all Jews. But also it doesn't permit, you know, accusations of anti-Semitism against people who are criticizing the state, whether it's simply for being the state or for its policies or for its actions, right? We're allowed to do that with every other state, but not, of course, Israel. Right? You know, my own university at Wake Forest, last year, and I've just learned this year to come, we're going to be having, I forget what they call it, but it's an Israel ambassador on campus. And this is someone who's paid by the Jewish agency to my campus and one or two others that are nearby, simply to do Israel activism on campus among the students. In part, it's a response to me and other faculty on campus who've been critical of Israel. But of course, what other state would do this kind of work, right? Could you imagine Russia sending sort of a Russian ambassador to do pro-Russia activism and that being seen as a good thing widely, or China or Iran, right? Any other state. But with Israel, it seemed like this is a terrific thing. Like, people welcome this person. The person is paid directly by the Jewish agency to do this work, right? And so this charge that somehow criticizing Israel for its policies is anti-Semitic because it's applying a double standard to Israel. Well, the truth is, like, the double standard is coming on their end, right? Because what they're doing is they're saying, we can do whatever we want as a state and you can't criticize us. Something that does, a standard that no other state insists upon. I can't hear you, Jeff. You're not muted, but I can't hear
you. Sorry, no, I was muted. I mute myself on my microphone. Anyway, if there are no other questions, it is exactly an hour when you've got your family responsibilities.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'll have one last chance for someone to, if anyone has a last question. Then we thank you very much. And we've learned a lot.
Thank you.
And it'll help us to encourage us to try to send a thing to our legislators and city councilmen and stuff like that with a little bit more.
I appreciate the opportunity. Right. And okay. Please feel free to be in touch with me. I'll put my email in the chat in case anybody wants to be in touch, now or any point in the future. Feel free to reach out to me. Go ahead. Take good care, everyone. Okay. Thank you very much.
Jeff, I wrote you a private message in the chat asking about the false reporting about the LA incident. If you can just send me an email with some information on that, I would really like to hear it.
Dick, can you do that? Because you've got more data on it than I do.
Okay. Particularly if there's a link.
Penny knows. We could talk about it right now.
I was going to say, because I didn't know about that.
Yeah. Okay. That's, if others want to hear it and you want to stay a minute.
Okay. Well, this is what we know, Penny. You'll fill in. I found it very odd that the idea that some guy would drive in from Banning with this Latino name, and someone else who might have been an Arab, we don't even know his identity, from Irvine. So that's probably a 2-hour drive, and they had a car with a convoy of 3 cars driving up and down Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood, which is, I guess there's some Russian Jews in the eastern part of West Hollywood, but it's not known as a Jewish city by any means. According to Penny, who knew people, who talked to people who were there,
I talked to with Rabbi Ari Cohen.
Oh yeah, he talked, apparently some of the diners, when these people were going by, yelled at him, and somebody who threw the bottle, the people in the car.
Well, that was unknown. But what the way? Okay, first of all, I examined the tapes, the videos, and what happened was that the diners were videoing the cars as they came by, and then the cars were in the southern direction, and the disturbance, sort of emanated from the south of where the diners were, and came back at them. So what Arye Cohen said, that he spoke with a woman who was in that caravan, and she said that they were stopped for a red light. And apparently, you know, the diners kind of like, when, as they were stopped, well, from the video, you can see that the Palestinians on, in the caravan are.
We don't know they were Palestinians. They might have been anybody.
Well, I mean, with the Palestinian, you know, those who were waving the Palestinian flag, okay, were using a loudspeaker, and but you could basically tell that they were far away, and you know they had very distinctive sound. Okay, in the video, you can hear somebody, probably one of the diners, was yelling "fuck you." Okay. The cars went, you know, continued going by, and then apparently stopped at the stoplight. It was, you know, a bottle flew. I would imagine that, you know, people don't, I don't know, whatever, you know, and then it, then the melee started. But my main point was this was a situation of protesters and counter protesters, the diners on the sidewalk. And by the time the narrative became known, the narrative was given by the diners, and they were claiming anti-Semitism when in essence, you know, they were just basically counter protesting. And I don't think the issue of Jewish and non-Jewish really came up. It was basically, so I, you know, I started looking at this before the people were arrested. So I didn't know where the people came from, and who knows, this may be a false flag, kind of thing, as you know, you're intimating, but I just don't know, you know, to me, it just seemed that this was, you know, being described as anti-Semitic when it shouldn't have been.
A couple reports I heard said that some of the people from the vehicles approached the diners and said, who here is a Jew, or are you Jewish?
Well, that I imagine was the narrative that was right. given by the diners.
But there's no evidence of that in the video.
No.
In the video.
What I found interesting, I looked at the all the video I could find that had been posted. They said the pushing went on for 15 minutes, and the only thing that was ever made public was about 15 or 20 seconds. And you couldn't tell anything. It just showed a bunch of people like all dressed in black kind of pushing each other. And they had some kind of like a flagpole or some piece of furniture that they were pushing back and forth.
There, around the sushi restaurant, there were poles with, what do you call those things? The
ribbons.
What?
A heating element?
No, not a heating element. You know, what you usually find in theaters to make order in the line, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. a stanchion, you know, it usually holds ropes. Okay.
Oh yeah.
And a velvet line.
Okay, but the pole is fairly, you know, has a base and is fairly heavy. And to me, it looked like one of the diners initially picked that up and was attacking, you know, south or defending, you know, in a very aggressive way, going south towards the Palestinians who, you know.
Well, they were pro-Palestinian, but we should avoid saying, I mean, there's not a shred of evidence.
Okay, yeah, I'm using shorthand, I'm sorry. Pro-Palestinians. So it seemed to me that that was pretty aggressive on the part of, if you take a look at the video, it's one of the diners who picks up that stanchion, that pole, and goes down, and then he loses control of that to one of the pro-plan.
Max Blumenthal, the journalist on the Gray Zone, did a very long piece in which he looked at this incident, more detail, one in New York, looked at the record keeping of the Anti-Defamation League, and another one in Toronto. And he said these were all highly ambiguous incidents in which it appeared as if a lot of times it was pro-Palestinian, but not necessarily, we don't even know who they were, demonstrators who were being attacked and pushing back, yeah. Not that they were initiating an attack. And also Jewish Currents had a story similar to that. They didn't mention Max Blumenthal, but I thought of that because Barry Trachtenberg said he wrote something for Jewish Currents as well. But I can tell you one thing, the mainstream and right-wing media like Breitbart News immediately picked the story up. They ran with it and they said mobs are attacking Jews in the United States. And I don't think there's any basis for any claim that Jews are being attacked by mobs in the United States. The most you could claim was there were highly isolated incidents in one in New York and one in LA. And they came one was on a Wednesday 2 weeks ago and one was on a Thursday 2 weeks ago. Oh, and there was an incident just like this in London. I read there was one in London, the same, exactly the same. It was like a convoy of a few cars waving flags. So that also makes it suspicious. I mean, why all of a sudden do you have exactly the same thing happening in three major cities? It doesn't pass my smell test. In other words, it's just a suspicion on my part, but it's very odd, you know?
Yeah, it's hard. It's gonna be hard to prove one way or the other, but I mean, having just judging from the protests that we had here in Sacramento, there were a lot of vehicles with Palestinian flags flying. It became kind of a motif of these protests, of young people in these vehicles, some of them standing on the roof or out the window with the flags. So that certainly existed. I can certainly imagine that they would have, you know, continued driving around the streets, waving the flags afterwards, not only at the protests. Who attacked whom is the interesting question. And we probably don't know for sure. But one thing I noted in the chat, I don't know if everybody saw it. I looked through a list of ADL reported incidents of anti-Semitism, and just the preponderance of them was this chanting by Palestinians at the protests with something that is arguably anti-Semitic, you know, coming from the ancient Muslim tradition of with the Battle of Khaybar, where apparently, according to the legend anyway, Muhammad's forces did massacre a bunch of Jews. There are certainly other contrary examples of better relations in the Quran, from what I understand. I'm not an expert, but that just that chant in itself is, you know, I mean, a lot of times people chant stupid things at rallies, and when some people started chanting that at the one in Sacramento, my Palestinian friends quickly went over to them and said, "Stop it." So it's certainly not a universal characteristic, but the bigger thing that I wrote about in the chat was that in this list of incidents that ADL published, there, you know, they talk about using Nazi imagery, right? And basically equating two things that are really the polar opposites of each other. One of which is calling Israeli behavior Nazi-like, which may not be a very effective way of getting your point across, but that is not necessarily anti-Semitic at all. It's, you know, doing Nazi analogies are overused in many, many contexts in political speech in this country. And that's really all that was. And then a few of the incidents they reported were people actually using Nazi slogans to attack Jews. That is definitely anti-Semitic, but they're equating them as if those are both the same when they're really totally opposite of each other.
David, I haven't looked at the ADL stuff for 2020, but I looked at it from 2019 and previous years. And
this is just a list of very recent incidents.
Okay,
of the last couple weeks.
David, do you have a link to that you could put on the chat?
I'll look for it. Go ahead and say your thing, Dick.
Okay. So in previous years, the ADL cataloged it like violence against people, violence against institutions, threats, all fairly innocuous, except for the shooting in Poway, where three people were, I think, or one or two people were killed, in Pittsburgh, where I think at the Tree of Life synagogue, nine people were killed. But the other stuff was usually like someone being hassled on the street or something like that. And they couldn't link any of these incidents to campus groups like Students for Justice in Palestine. I found that interesting. So this is a new strategy or new bit of record keeping by the ADL to try to kind of modify their statistics to...
What is the category, the new category?
Anti-Israel activity, criticism of Israel as being anti-Semitic. They didn't have anything from 2019, 2018, 2017. Oh, really? There wasn't even one incident where they could say on a campus some pro-Palestinian group did something that registered on their list of anti-Semitic incidences. So this is a new development.
So I posted the link on the what I was talking about on the chat. You can take a look at it.
Jeff, I seem
to say thank you. I saw it and I opened it. Uri?
I just wanted to add, I missed the whole conversation. I didn't realize it started at 6 p.m. But based on this thing, I always look to see who gains. In other words, who stands to gain? And what would the ADL do without anti-Semitism? That's my question to them always. Would you close the organization or you find new people that after you? In other words, when somebody has obviously a reason of survival, it has to do with money, with reputation, with all of that thing. Or off the bat, I suspect, I don't buy. So all of a sudden, there's like from 100 to 2,000 incidents. I say, wait, guys, that's too much for me to believe you. And the moment I suspect your integrity, I don't listen to anything you say. Because in my book, if you lie once, that's it. In other words, you cannot be virgin and give a birth and then become a virgin again. Once you lie, that's it. You lost it. And in my opinion, ADL lost it long time ago. And the fact that Marvin hires another jerk supporting them takes the whole thing off for me for something that I can even believe in, listen to. So this is my personal. I'm sharing it with you because that's my perspective on this thing. Now, the whole conversation about whether they were pro-Palestinians, Palestinians, just people who were looking for action and they found an excuse, no clue. That's what I had to say about this thing. And for me, the biggest thing that Netanyahu did, the biggest thing that he did, he was able to remove the distinction between Zionism, Judaism, Israel, and anti-Semitism. He made the whole thing pasta fagioli. Everything is the same. And the moment he did that, the moment you say anything about Israel, you're either anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew. So in other words, there's no room to criticize us because we are holier than thou. So this is really something that I'm sure a lot of people notice. I'm not the only one who noticed that he actually collapsed the whole thing. And the whole conversation about the definition of anti-Semitism came because of that, because he wanted to actually blame everybody who's supporting to BDS to be an anti-Semite. You cannot do that unless you're anti-Semite. And he was able to do that. He muddied the water to the point that a lot of serious people bought the bait. I mean, took the bait. It's amazing to me, but anyhow, that's kind of like my opinion on the matter.
Well, actually, the whole U.S. Jewish establishment has been pushing that same idea that there's no difference between Israel and Jews.
But it came from Netanyahu. He started it. He basically...
It came.
But he's the main push behind it. He propagated it. He directed the Israeli propaganda to go on that line. He was basically throwing this line as harsh as he can and as... Because basically for him is like, everybody's an anti-Semite. The moment you say something against me, you're anti-Semite. Okay.
I saw Asim, if I'm pronouncing your name right, made a little comment about the Battle of Khyber. I was not at all familiar with it before last week when I sort of read about this in the ADL thing and heard that some people at one of the protests here were saying it. Is there an interpretation of that that would be useful for us to know better?
Well, yes. Basically, when Muhammad went from Mecca to Medina, and the people of Medina accepted his idea of Islam, there were several tribes, Jewish tribes, living in Medina also, along with everybody else. I mean, they were basically Arabs, just that they have the Jewish religion. And the agreement was that they would all bind together, since they all are residents of that city, to defend themselves against the enemy. The enemy was at this time the people from coming from Mecca. And what happened was one Jewish tribe opened the back lines, basically, and allowed the army of Mecca to come and try to get into the city of Medina. Luckily, the Jewish tribes, along with the people of Muhammad, won the war at the time. And so after the war, they got together and they said, okay, this one tribe, one Jewish tribe that broke the agreement must be punished. As it was, that was the way it was done in those days. And they did, they basically, the way it was, the punishment was, is that they basically kill the man and take the women as sabaya, they call them. And that's what happened, you know. And the goods of those people were distributed along as war tributes between all the Jewish tribes and the people of Muhammad equally.
So just to be clear, that when you say the army of Mecca that was attacking Medina, the army of Mecca was not Muhammad, right? He was already in Medina. So exactly. He was defending Medina. So
he was defending, yeah. The people of Mecca were the ones who were, of course, the rulers of that area and were benefiting from all the business of the religious business of people coming to Mecca and once a year, and they would spend money and so on. So they were very, very, very rich. And yeah. So they didn't like this new guy coming up with a new religion and, you know, creating problems.
Do you have any thoughts on the use of that legendary, possibly historical event in as the slogan that people are saying? That they're saying Khyber, Khyber, Ya Yahud, and then I would butcher the Arabic. They said Muhammad's army is coming for you, is apparently the slogan as it's translated by ADL. Have you heard that, and what would you attribute it?
There is no such thinking whatsoever. The fighting was not against that tribe because they were Jewish. They were against that tribe by the other Jewish tribes along with Muhammad.
No, I understand, but on the streets today, have you heard people say that? And if so, what you
know? I hear, unfortunately, I hear all kinds of nonsense from both sides, you know, unfortunately. I received today an article from a friend. He was telling me how he had anti-Semitism. He's a Jewish professor, and how he tried to get into Harvard professor and he had a hard time because he's Jewish and so on. And I told him I had the same problems as an Arab with my Jewish professors at UCLA. It's, you know, c'est la vie, you know. There are people who are anti-Semitic, whether they're anti-Semitic against the Jews or anti-Semitic against the Arabs. We're all Semites, but that exists, basically.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. Uri, you have something?
I just had a thought. One of the things that, you know, because the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism is so Israel and Palestine centric, there really isn't a part which talks about looking at diaspora Jews as, you know, one and the same. And, you know, we've talked about how it's insulting that Israel is identified as the Jewish, you know, entity, where it in within Zionism, there's also the negation of the diaspora, where essentially the which Netanyahu was, when there were attacks in Paris, he was saying, "Oh, all the French Jews should come to Israel." That, and there's this assumption that if you stay in the diaspora, whatever happens to you, it's free game. And this is not that different from, some Christians who, even some Nazis who will say, Jews to Palestine and all, or Jews to Israel, which I perceive as somewhat anti-Semitic. And this is kind of anti-Semitism that comes from, Israel, the right, and, the evangelist Christian community sometimes. So that there's actually nothing in the, in some formal statement which protects our rights as Jews outside of Israel. So anyhow, that was the thought. And I don't want to keep you guys. But
Uri?
I wanted to add a couple of things. First of all, with regards to the Kaaba, there's a whole conversation about the fact that because of Muhammad, the Arabs are entitled to two kinds of peace agreements. One that they intend to keep, and one that they can break.
Uri, can you get a little closer to your microphone, please? It's hard to hear.
All right. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
So they use the historic, supposedly historic thing that allows them to have two kinds of agreements, a truce and a peace agreement. And they distinguish it in the language. So basically they say Muhammad promised not to attack them, and he did. And he broke his word, but that's okay because he didn't mean a lasting peace. He meant a temporary one till I'm getting harder, till I get stronger, till I can overcome you, can I hurt you? And this is a conversation that I heard in the last, I don't know how long, with the Hamas. That basically the Israelis don't trust them because, hey, which agreement is it? The one that you're going to keep or the one that you're going to break? So this is just a note from continuation of that historic conversation about Muhammad and Mecca and Medina. So that's one thing. Another remark is that about the whole confluence of Netanyahu did it on purpose. The national law of Israel, basically making Israel the state of the Jewish people. That was done by design. Basically, he wanted to make sure that he is the king of the Jews and he speaks for them. So anytime you touch a Jew anywhere in the world, he's entitled to respond on his behalf, whether the Jews want to be protected by him or not, whether they want to be represented by him or not, whether they even care for him or not. He's all of a sudden is the patron of the Jews in the world, and you don't have a choice. He already decided that you're part of it, whether you like it or not, whether you choose to live in Israel or not. I'm protecting you because there are bad guys who are going to kill you because you're a Jew. And one of the points that I make to all my Israeli friends, I said, guys, you always claim that Israel is the safest place for Jews in the world. It's exactly the opposite. More than 24,000 Jews and Israelis, but Israelis died since 1948 as Jews. How many Jews die as Jews in the United States? Yeah, there was a Trump and there was a few of them that were killed in the temple in Pittsburgh, and a couple were hurt in San Diego. Israel is not the safest place for Jews in the world. On the contrary, it's the most dangerous place in the world for Jews because more Jews die there as Jews than anywhere in the world. But go try to convince them that this is exactly the opposite. So this is kind of the contention on that issue, that Israel is the safest place, and me, Netanyahu, I'm in charge of all of you, and I'll protect you, I'm the mighty one, and I'll do that. So just a point to kind of like enlighten that thing, because most people buy the story. So that's my challenge to them, amongst others.
A question for you. I've never seen Israel ever send any military units or police units to the diaspora to help Jews protect themselves. Their response to all of these incidences of anti-Semitism is simply say you need to move to Israel to be protected, but they don't make the slightest effort to protect things. I mean, synagogues that hire security guards, they just go to some private company that does security. You know, they don't go to the Israeli consulate and say, send us some commandos who are trained in protecting buildings. It doesn't happen. So the idea that Israel is there to protect Jews from anti-Semitism is a myth. They don't do it. They just use it as an opportunity to promote Aliyah.
But of course, the whole thing is fabricated.
Yeah.
Fabrication. However, like Goebbels said, if you repeat something long enough, it becomes a truth. And I heard it so many times from so many people. Israel is the safest place for the Jews in the world. They say, really? Check the numbers.
Yeah.
But the problem is, we got to the point that we are not talking on the same realities. Trump made it okay that there are going to be two realities, the real reality and Trump's reality. And he lets people live in there in that reality, which reminds me of a joke and diverting. But what's the difference I don't want to, I'll come back to the joke. Never mind. I'm angry with it already.
Actually, Dick, there are programs where, you know, police are funded to go to Israel by Jewish groups, and they are trained by, you know, who knows the equivalent of, you know, they're experts in quote unquote, you know, anti-terrorism, and then they come back and they're supposed to, you know, have better capabilities of protecting the Jewish community. And
mostly they just attack blacks. I've never heard of the police using any techniques they learned in Israel to protect Jews. I mean,
they do get free trips.
Well, that's true, and Israel gets political benefits, but I've always been highly skeptical that the American police need to be trained in how to do political.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely correct. You're correct, but
political indoctrination, that's what it is. The bad guys, the Arabs, the Muslims, after you, so you American policemen, watch out. See, we are the front, we defend the world, but you watch at the back because they're gonna come after you too. Because if we are not here, you're going to suffer there. So the Muslims there, they're going to come to America, protect your communities. And they preach it to a lot of Christian fundamentals who are in the police forces. So it's basically kind of like the same thing. They just, anyhow, we see that. Probably most people don't see it. It's too obscure for most people, or most people don't have the time to even read or listen.
Yep. Anyhow.
Okay, should we call it quits, guys, or does somebody
else? I think so. Yeah. Great.
Okay.
All right.
Just to remind you, if I can have your attention for a second or two. This is what's coming up Sunday at 10 o'clock. We have Emily Schaefer Obermann on litigating the occupation. And these things are all listed in the announcement of the meeting. But next Sunday at 10 o'clock, Emily Schaefer Obermann, and hope to see you all there.
Up next Sunday, you're wrong.
Yeah, I can't make it on Sunday, sorry.
Not this Sunday, it's the Sunday after.
Yeah, this it not this Sunday, the Sunday after. You're right, Uri.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you all.
If I can. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Okay. Goodbye.